So I'll just begin by introducing myself. My name is Lance Donaldson Evans. I'm professor of Romance Languages and teach French at the University of Pennsylvania, and I am the chair of the advisory committee for the Lorraine Beitler Dreyfus Collection. And you'll notice that I say Dreyfus, that's because I'm originally from Australia and I teach French, and that's the way we say it there. So you know what I mean. I'm sure there won't be any confusion, if you'll pardon me this idiosyncrasy. It's my pleasure, on behalf of the advisory committee, to welcome you all to what promises to be a very exciting afternoon. And I'd also like to extend a special thanks to our distinguished guest speakers, Karen Greenberg and Clemens Nathan, as well as to a representative of the Dreyfus family, Alfred Dreyfus's great-granddaughter, Yael Pell-Ruiz, who is here with us today and who came all the way from Paris to be present at this important event. The Beitler Dreyfus collection consists of over 1,000 items documenting the history of the Dreyfus affair. And these, of course, as we all know, were donated by Lorraine Beitler to the University of Pennsylvania. This unique collection is a precious resource for scholars, but also has as one of its goals the stimulation of discussion on important issues raised by the Dreyfus affair in France, namely prejudice, racism, social injustice, and the role of the media and democratic institutions in the righting of injustice. One of the activities promoted by the committee has been an annual lecture series, of which this afternoon's event is the third, and as you also know, you wouldn't be here, it's that today's event is devoted to the topic of human rights in the 21st century. It's now my pleasure to introduce the moderator for this afternoon's presentation, one of our committee members, Jermaine Ingram, who will then formally introduce our speakers and use her considerable skills as a moderator when we move to questions and discussion. And just a couple of words about Jermaine. If I were to tell you all her activities and all her talents, it would take me probably 45 minutes if I was speaking very fast. So this will be a very, very brief thumbnail sketch of Jermaine, who is the deputy director of the Philadelphia Folklore Project. Previously, she served as director of site development for the Benefit Bank, a program of Solutions for Progress, which is a technology consulting firm based in Philadelphia. Before joining Solutions for Progress, Jermaine had a very diverse career as a trial lawyer and legal services attorney, a law professor at both Temple and Penn, general counsel and deputy superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia, vice president for the Black Community Crusade for Children of the Children's Defense Fund, and program director for nonprofit organizations involved with school reform, out-of-school programming, and youth development. She's also served on the boards of numerous other organizations. Now, Jermaine has another career as well. She's also a professional tap dancer and choreographer, and she's performed and had her pieces presented nationally and internationally. She holds a BA in political science from Syracuse University, a doctor of laws from the University of Pennsylvania, was a fellow in law and humanities at Harvard University, and holds an honorary doctorate from Rosemont College in Pennsylvania. So I present our moderator, Jermaine Ingram. Thank you, Jermaine.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm sure you're sitting there saying, this is truly a schizophrenic woman. I am so honored to be a member of the Beitler Collection Advisory Committee. From the perspective of membership on that committee, I have been consistently educated and inspired by the intellect and the energy of the founder and the driving force behind that collection, Lorraine Beitler. I'm also really pleased to be moderator this afternoon for what promises to be a really stimulating and an engaging lecture, the third in the series of lectures connected with the Beitler Collection. Our guests today, Clemens Nathan and Karen Greenberg, are two of the most accomplished and profound thinkers, teachers, and writers on the topic of human rights. We've given them a wide berth to share their views and perspectives on this really important and timely topic. I know we're all looking forward to hearing from them. Let me just tell you a little bit about our format today. Each speaker will share views for up to about 30 minutes. And then we'll engage in a conversation between the two speakers and between the speakers and you. We try to provide a substantial amount of time for a true conversation, discourse on these really meaty issues. Following the lecture, there will be a reception right outside the lecture hall, and there will be an opportunity for you to purchase copies of Karen Greenberg's latest book, which I'm sure she'll be happy to autograph for for you. You've already been asked to silence your phones and other devices. So I'm going to be much more succinct in introducing our speakers than Lance was in introducing me. And I'm going to, in lieu of talking about their biographies, I selected a couple of quotes, short quotes, one for each of them, that I hope will give you a sense of their passion for this topic of human rights. In his prologue to the volume Racism and Human Rights by Raphael Walden, or edited by Raphael Walden, Clemens Nathan says, "Today, in the communication age, the international community has a multitude of instruments aimed at increasing respect for the different ways in which people can strive for liberty and security, despite their diverse ideologies and beliefs. If we do not take up the challenge of using the new forms of international communication for the benefit of mankind, we shall instead be handing these new technological tools over to fanatics committed to hatred and conflict, who claim to speak in the name of the very values of dignity, rights, and peace upon which they trample." Karen Greenberg, an article that was published only about a month ago, states, "In the days and weeks to come, as more and more detainees find their way out of Guantanamo, perhaps some of their faces and names will come before the public and thus help us reckon with the past. Together, perhaps, the lawyers, the press, and yes, the U.S. authorities can show us the expressions of those who have suffered in the U.S. in U.S. custody. Without this ability to attach personal stories to the shameful episode of Guantanamo, it is all too possible that the harm it has caused will pass into history as only an aberration, rather than a full-fledged attack on human beings. Only by acknowledging the humanity of the detainees can the United States begin to reclaim the spirit of compassion that has fallen by the wayside in the wake of 9/11. As our first speaker, I introduce Clemens Nathan.
It's very nice to hear something quoted from a book which I had written long ago. I had quite forgotten about it. Thank you very much. I'm delighted. Can you hear me all? I'm delighted by the opportunity to contribute to this prestigious occasion. This is my first visit to Philadelphia, and it has a very special meaning. As a child, my parents took me to Penn in Buckinghamshire, where we had a wonderful lunch on a Sunday, followed by going to the Quaker House, the old Quaker House where William Penn used to go, and we sat there contemplating about life in general. It had a deep impact on me, and I always wondered why William Penn left the lovely leafy trees of Buckinghamshire for the godforsaken hole at that time of American continent. Anyway, what I was shown yesterday impressed me so much that it's quite remarkable what a beautiful place for me Philadelphia is, with its rivers and the hilltops and everything. William Penn, I've been told, chose the new Philadelphia, the name Philadelphia, because it meant brotherly love, from the Greek philos, love, and Adelphos, brother. And he wanted it to be a place where religious tolerance and freedom to worship were ensured. This makes it a particularly apt location for the study of human rights. In 1693, Penn wrote a plan for the present and future peace of Europe, which included settling disputes between nations by arbitration instead of war. This plan is considered a prototype of the United Nations, which acknowledges this legacy by celebrating UN Day on Penn's birthday, October the 24th. As if this were not enough, I might also add that I also used to often pass the Foundry in the east of London, where the Liberty Bell was cast. I gather from information that it was cracked. I'm appalled that such a thing could happen to something coming from my country to yours. But it did still ring, despite its defect, when the emancipation of the Catholics took place in Great Britain and on many other important occasions relating to human rights that have taken place. Throughout recorded history, there have always been moments of deep depression followed by joyful occasions. In a strange way, we live in such an age today. The challenges are probably different to those of the past. In order to understand the situation in the 21st century, which Karen Greenberg will be developing, I think it's essential that we look at some of the history of human rights. Most would agree that the concept of rights is the product of European political thought from the 17th and 18th centuries. The idea of rights is not something that is common to all civilizations. It is not always upheld by those who are familiar with it, hence the continued need to lobby governments and target organizations. From the earliest times of recorded history, ethical systems have at their core convictions about human behavior. One of the earliest examples I came across was the Sumerian king Hammurabi, who modified human interaction and behavior in his 282 laws, which formed a legally binding system to protect people. Although his punishments were exceptionally cruel, in his laws, for example, a builder had a contractual duty to his client that the building he was constructing would not fall down, which would be a template for many similar obligations and responsibilities between people. For example, if the building did fall down and the builder was killed, then the builder had to be killed. If the owner and his son were killed, then the builder and his son were to be killed. That was one of Hammurabi's straightforward laws. Even earlier than this, Judaism interpreted a moral code based on what was called a revealed divine law to bring order out of chaos. The Mosaic laws, the Ten Commandments, estimated to be dated around or slightly before the time of Hammurabi, are a good example. They continue to have an influence even today on Western society. They give an emphasis on the dignity of all human beings and highlight the duties and obligation which we all have towards each other. Tikkun Olam is the Hebrew for repairing the world. This came from these earlier concepts. We must look after ourselves our families, our communities, and the world, and leave the planet in a decent state to the next generation. The much-used idiom, save a life, save the world, is part of the Hebraic concept. These, in turn, influence many later traditions, religions, bills of rights, quite impressive. Much later, we have the Greek Socratic traditions, perfecting the order of the universe. Then came the immaterial concepts of Plato, permitting the wise to order the lives of the others. Slaves were not part of this society. The Roman, much later of course, Ulpian, who died in 228 AD, believed that natural rights belonged to everybody, irrespective of whether they were Roman citizens or not. Another Roman, Justinian, in 527 AD, wrote the great Codex of Laws, trying to establish a cohesive system of rights and duties for Roman citizens only. Magna Carta was created to curtail the power of King John of England, as you know. It emphasized the right of the church to be free from governmental interference and the rights of all free citizens to own and inherit property and be exempt from excessive taxes. It also established the right of widows who had owned property to choose not to remarry and established principles of due process and equality before the law, but only for the gentry. Although it was based on customary law already in existence, there were many things in it which gradually evolved into human rights. For example, Article 39 of the Magna Carta emphasized that no free man shall be arrested, imprisoned, expropriated, exiled, or in any way ruined, except by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. Concern in England with rights had culminated in the English Revolution in 1640, when Charles I was executed and the country was run by Oliver Cromwell. The Glorious Revolution, as it was afterwards called, of 1688 led to an English Bill of Rights in 1689. From then onwards, British monarchs would never again claim that their power was derived directly from God. It ended the concept there of the divine right of kings. The bill made Charles II subject to the rule of law like everyone else, which was rather than being the divine source of the law. The act also protected some basic rights of justice and independent juries were guaranteed. The Bill of Rights, interestingly enough, encompassed some of the agreements of Magna Carta, which of course this time included the whole population, not just the aristocracy. In the 17th and 18th century, we had some major philosophers important for this development. Grotius, Hobbes, Locke, Bentham, and Paine created debate on what are natural rights and the rights of man throughout Europe on most political agendas. The most influential probably was, I think, you may agree with me, Hugo Grotius, who believes that law is independent of God, although he himself was a devout Christian. He wanted to separate ethics from theology and highlighted a secular theory of natural rights. Two dramatic things happened in your country influencing philosophers. In 1776, which I'm sure you are all more familiar with than me, but I felt it relevant to draw your attention to one important paragraph in the American Declaration of Independence, which stated, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Unfortunately, as we know, this declaration was not applied to African people during the time of slavery, and the rights of women were also not recognized. Both of these only came about much later. In the Declaration of Independence, religion still played a major role, but the emphasis was put on rights from a belief in the dignity of the human being that is grounded in a belief in a creator. 12 years later, the French Revolution led to the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizens, asserting the primacy of natural rights, which, as we know, degenerated into terror. While these momentous concepts were created in the newly formed United States and France, there evolved in Germany a different type of philosophy. Immanuel Kant believed that the freedom of every individual should not impinge on the freedom of others, but at the same time, in his book, Kritik der Vernunft, Reason and Common Sense, he suggested that everyone should act in such a way that all will be well if everyone else acted like he did, or those like him. Kant's ethics asserted human reason as the ultimate authority in ethical decisions, maintaining that every free person could claim this moral code as his or her own. Although it was not founded on religion, what he postulated was, he maintained, based on the existence of God. He had a big influence on Friedrich Nietzsche, among others, who took Kant's arguments to an extreme, abandoning God totally and postulating the freedom of the individual as a superman. There was the impact of a much earlier person in Germany called Martin Luther, who advised the princes in Germany not to interfere with the church. This enabled the state to later carry out its immoral behavior in Germany without interference of the church, who felt it was not their responsibility to deal with racial intolerance. These fascinating historical events, including the nightmare of the Nazi theory of nationhood, founded on this ideology of a superman, that Germans were a superior race, ultimately kick-started the modern-day human rights movement as we know it today. In the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution made changes in human rights very important as society evolved from an agrarian one in which the aristocracy had looked after their workers to an industrialized one in which they did not. So in these circumstances, the workers had to take ownership of their own welfare to get better rights in factories. Several other important philosophers had also been on the scene at this time. John Stuart Mill, around 1806 and died in 1873, argued that Bentham concepts of utilitarianism, which I mentioned earlier, in which there should always be the greatest amount of good for the greatest number of people, was absolutely wrong. He argued that we need to exist with other people, and minorities also need to have rights, not to be under the tyranny of a majority. Freedom of expression and association should not deprive others of the ability to have their own ability, liberty. After the development of organized labor and John Stuart Mill, one which comes to mind is the energetic campaign of William Wilberforce. His declaration failed to protect generations of Africans from the atrocity of the transatlantic slave trade, during which horrific numbers died and were forced into being slaves. Wilberforce managed to get the abolition of trading slaves in England through the House of Commons, although it continued for some time elsewhere in the colonies, and slave ownership was not made illegal. His views were influenced by Enlightenment thinking, that is, the belief in progress through self-reliant reason, as opposed to tradition and authoritarianism. His views were certainly not religious, as none of the Christian contemporaries of his time were interested in this subject. Florence Nightingale and the less known, but no less remarkable, Mary Seacole were two women who pioneered for improving the rights of soldiers and military medical services during the Crimean War. It was at this time also that your President Lincoln issued instructions for the government of armies of the United States in the field, known as the Lieber Code. The protection of the victims of war came about from these efforts and developed into the Geneva Conventions for the Assistance of Wounded Soldiers. This in turn led to the establishment of the International Conference of the Red Cross, which transformed international law. The International Committee of the International Red Cross is arguably the most widely known and respected competent body of worldwide significance operating in the global sphere today. I would also like to highlight the 1814-15 Congress of Vienna and the 1878 Treaty of Berlin, which called for the protection of civil and religious liberties of individuals. However, the carving up of Africa in 1884 at the Berlin Conference for the commercial interests of European countries caused many long-term problems for the people of Africa. I could not close the 19th century without acknowledging the incredible impact which Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels had on political thought. Their views argued that rights were always conceived by ruling classes and therefore entailed the exploitation of the working class. They demanded that food and work were the most fundamental of human rights. Unlike John Stuart Mill, Marx had another definition of liberty, something to be gained through government rather than a freedom from interference by government. Equality for them was more important than liberty, especially in the ownership of private property, a fundamental tenet of communism. Only one fundamental individual right existed under their system. That was the right of revolution. As Marx saw it, this then avoided the mistake of being tied only to a bourgeois class. Probably their philosophy had more impact on millions of people through the 20th century than we could possibly have predicted when their theories were first produced. And no one could have imagined the brutality of Stalin's regime alone. The collapse of the delicate framework of the Peace of Westphalia of 1648 came at the beginning of the 20th century and created one of the bloodiest periods in the history of civilization. After the First World War, the League of Nations and its charter were created to affirm the duty of all member states to refrain from force against each other, to raise the issue of human rights worldwide. The 1919 Versailles Conference was especially concerned with the protection of minorities, but it made no attempt at universality, nor did it concern itself with all minorities. The reorganization of European states after the First World War involved the colonization of some non-European countries as part of a new world order. Human rights for the indigenous people of these countries were not considered. It failed to preserve the peace of Europe. During the Second World War, the Allies aimed to defend life, liberty, and religious freedom, and to protect human rights. Following the Holocaust, the sheer atrocities committed by the Nazis through enslavement and annihilation of Jews and other groups in Europe and elsewhere caused the world to look in embarrassment at what had happened and how it had been possible that 6 million Jews alone had been exterminated, of whom 1.5 million were children. not to mention over 20 million killed and murdered on the Russian front during the Stalin regime. Human rights could no longer be a matter of domestic concern for a nation alone after such an event, and must become in theory a universal concern for every person on earth. How could one protect the individual's rights universally rather than establishing specific laws for specific settings? The term human rights first really appeared in the Washington Declaration in 1942 and was included in the aims of the Allied efforts. This development of rights in the 20th century was significant as it emphasized the link between future international peace, international humanitarian law, and the definition and protection of human rights. The human being became at last a recognized individual beside the state with rights and duties that the international community of states undertook to protect and develop. The Dumbarton-Oakes proposals in 1944, negotiated by the Big Four, China, the USSR, United Kingdom, and the United States, were the foundation of the Commission on Human Rights, set up later in February 1946. This became the chief policy-making body of the UN in protecting individuals. It was partly its chairman, René Cassin's terrible experiences after the First World War of war widows receiving no compensation from the French government, and the nightmares of the Second World War, which made him so determined and enthusiastic to draft the Declaration of Human Rights, which was passed at the UN. He had the support of Charles Malik and Eleanor Roosevelt. 48 of the members were in favor. There was no opposition and only a few abstentions. I'll come back to those later. It is considered today as one of the single instruments which has had an incredible impact on the development of legal thinking, both internationally and nationally. It has become a worldwide benchmark. It emphasized that it was to represent a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. Among these are the right to life, the right to not be tortured or enslaved, and to not be unfairly persecuted. It also declared the need for freedom of thought, expression, and religion. The cultural rights laid out include the right to marriage, education, employment, food, and shelter. It is a non-binding document, as it was only made as a resolution. Although 60 years have passed since the Declaration was created, genocides have continued unabated in many parts of the world. We can discuss this later, but most nations are aware of the Declaration and are conscious that it ought to be honored. It has not protected the individual country's people against genocide, despite the efforts by the UN to stop or reduce some. Many remarkable new law courts, however, have been created as a result of this Declaration, like the European Court of Human Rights, established in 1951, the Inter-American Court, established in 1969, the African Commission on Human People's Rights in 1986, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in 1991, and the International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda in 1994. I could talk for a long time about the development of the Council of Europe, which is representing 48 countries and 800 million people throughout Europe. It has spent a great deal of time and continues to do so on all aspects of human rights, including the avoidance of genocide. This organization is the fountainhead for human rights legislation at the 27 states of the European Union. It too has been influenced by the Declaration of Human Rights, and much of the 21st century will without doubt be influenced by all the different activities which the Council of Europe has instigated, ranging from ecology to traditions of different peoples, cultural forms for every type of race and religion, and separate organizations to look at intolerance. It's hoped that this work will avoid some of the terrible mistakes and stop wars between nations in the 21st century. Throughout the period I have covered, there have been endless debates on what human rights are based upon and to give explanations for them. But the arguments for and against these rights still continue. Where, for example, the limits of human rights? The development of Marxism in the 19th century based its attitude towards human rights on society's duties and obligations to the state and vice versa. The USSR delegation argued at the UN conference in 1946 in San Francisco that the state and the individual were in harmony with each other, so their interests naturally coincided. The delegation of Saudi Arabia at the debate on the Declaration of Human Rights made it clear that it could not be accepted as it did not coincide with the tenets of Islam and Sharia law. Some of the statements in the Declaration of Human Rights are, of course, extremely difficult to enforce immediately in countries where there is hunger and where every child has to work in order that people can stay alive. Nevertheless, the dream for them to stop child labor should not be forgotten. In the debates on establishing the Declaration of Human Rights, the Soviets were deeply concerned that the right to work did not get relegated to an inferior status, whereas my country emphasized social rights. The René Cassin's brilliance was to draft a preamble that indicated that all these rights were vital and related to the defining issue of human rights and dignity, which also pacified the British by indicating that these rights were of different but no lesser importance. The Chinese attitude towards human rights is much more complex than it may appear on the surface. In many provinces in China, there is a desire for more human rights, but the state is frightened of losing control and having a revolution because of dissidents. The enthusiasm for United States policy to bring capitalism there has a two-pronged effect. Firstly, providing the world with very cheap merchandise and allowing the Chinese population to develop and raise local standards of living in many parts of the country, which would have otherwise been unimaginable. Secondly, the Chinese are concerned and fear that opening the doors to a type of capitalism that will ultimately break up the rigid order which has advanced China's progress, that everyone has something to eat each day, even in some areas are still extremely poor and need state aid. The success, for example, of the Olympic Games in China last year was a remarkable achievement and surely would also have opened ideas in China to its important role as a world-class country. Despite the internal problems which they are trying to address, there is now world recognition of China's global position. In the last 20 years, we've seen the evolution of the concepts of other human rights discussing universalism versus cultural relativism. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with Ronald Dworkin in the latter half of the last century, who disagreed with Bentham's earlier rejection of natural rights without real laws. He did not accept the view that human rights are absolute and universal, and maintained that they were a creation of political systems that try to treat all people equally, irrespective of their social status. Like John Stuart Mill, Dworkin believed that ignoring the rights of minorities in the name of the greatest good for the majority always threatened to destroy the entire concept of individual human rights. We have seen in many cases genocides were started by those in power or by the people who were oppressed under their rule. John Rawls, on the other hand, among many others, believed that everything the state possessed, such as benefits, should be distributed equally, unless an unequal distribution would benefit the poorer classes most. world's views of human rights is constructed from the belief that people who created human rights rules must be reasonable people who were living together in a society. Cultural relativism, on the other hand, is in itself very arbitrary. Those who are most powerful often succeed. Those who deny rights to others in their culture do so to a large extent for their own benefit. Every society needs to try to avoid cultural imprisoned decisions of the few, unacceptable to and unrepresentative of the others, except where it is an elected body which needs to take into consideration other opinions. We've seen a recent movement, a new one, in various parts of the world towards the abolition of smoking in all indoor public places in an effort to improve public health. Is this the beginning of a new control over society which could develop into something more complex later and perhaps be dangerous? You've already experienced in your history the ineffectiveness of the prohibition of alcohol in 1919 to 1933. There are many simplistic interpretations also of universalism. Just look at some of the African tribes ruled by a chieftain and advised by the most senior villagers. Who is to say that this system is any less representative than the supposedly more liberal societies we have in the West? It's fascinating that in a UNESCO worldwide research project on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, many statesmen and scholars agreed that the list of human rights and values they received from all over the world were essentially very similar. Those who applied may have been better educated than the masses, but we all need the same basics. We all care about the same essential things. There is a common strand, what I like to call humanity, in all of us, irrespective of our cultural heritage. Perhaps this emanates from the mother who protects her own children, to the family unit, to the clan and the tribe, and then the state. Perhaps we are all engaged in the protection of our species, which has no religious or ethical element to it. But I think there is more to it than this. However, the selfish gene was highlighted by Richard Dawkins in his book of the same name, a view publicized by Desmond Morris in many television programs in England. Are human rights nothing more than the protection of the next generation? This surely cannot be the only truth, as we do fight for the rights of other people, tribes and nations, who may be alien to us. And this does show a sense of sacrifice that would not advance the selfish gene thesis. The awful Nazi concept of the master race with its selfish gene project could never be satisfactory for us all. There are so many other issues which I could talk about, but our time is limited. This is the Lorraine Bettler lecture, and as such, I'm delighted to thank her for highlighting the tragic suffering which Captain Dreyfus bore in the 19th century, at a time when France was fighting its own battle between loyalty to the army and human rights. It was here that the enormous influence of Emile Zola, among others, to correct injustices took place and succeeded. How remarkable that another great Frenchman, René Cassin, wrote the Declaration of Human Rights in 1946, carrying forward the tradition of justice which we hope will continue into the 21st century and beyond.